The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the Golden Age of Radio, an episode of Suspense from 1942 and Vic and Sadie from 1939. We'll also hear about Two Men in the Moon on a segment of Incredible But True, and Frank Sinatra narrates The Fight Against Polio from 1959. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, an episode of Vic and Sadie from 1939. We'll also hear about Two Men in the Moon on a segment of Incredible But True. And Frank Sinatra narrates The Fight Against Polio from 1959. Right now, here's the premiere episode of Suspense from 1942, starring Charlie Ruggles and Julie Hayden, as WMKY presents The Golden Age of Radio.
The Columbia Network takes pleasure in bringing you Suspense. Suspense. Stories from the world's great literature of pure excitement. A new series frankly dedicated to your horrification and entertainment. Week by week, from the pick of new material, from the pages of best-selling novels, from the theater of Broadway in London, and the sound stages of Hollywood, will parade the most remarkable figures ever known. CBS gives you Suspense. Tonight's presentation is one of the finest of the contemporary stories of mystery and terror, John Dixon Carr's famous novel, The Burning Court.
Ah, a glass of sherry by the fireside of a beautiful suburban home. What could be more comforting? You're an admirable host, Mr. Depart, and it's really a shame our first meeting is under such a cloud. It's also a shame I have so little time to tell you which one of your guests here... murdered your uncle last week. Now, let's see now. I believe we're all here. Your wife, your friend, Mr. Stevens, Captain Brennan.
Yes, and incidentally, yourself. Just who did you say you were?
Well, no wonder you've had so much difficulty with the case, Captain. My name is Cross, Gordon Cross, the writer. As a matter of fact, it's because of my just completed book, Poisoning Throughout the Ages, that I happen to be here now. And Ted Stevens there happens to be a member of the firm which publishes my work. I'd never seen him until tonight, but... I've been told what happened. This afternoon, he began reading my manuscript for the first time on the train. The commuter's train, which every afternoon deposits him safely and soundly here in Crispin. I imagine he was halfway home by the time he finished the first chapter. Then he turned a page. Attached to the following leaf was a picture. And looking at it, the young man stiffened suddenly and all but cried out his shock. It was a picture of a young woman, and under it had been printed, Famous Poisoner Marie Dobray, 1676. Ted Stevens was looking at a picture of his own wife. Imagine his 25-year-old wife in 17th century costume. The face, the features, even a wistfulness of expression were identical. Even the name. Dobray was his wife's maiden name. But no, that was ridiculous. This woman in the picture was, well, one of his wife's ancestors. Yes, that was it. Simply an amazing family resemblance. Marie would be waiting for him at the station, and he'd have to tell her about it. He wondered why, however, she'd never told him about. Oh, well, but you don't discuss such an ancestor, do you? Ted Stevens glanced down at the chapter to which the picture had been attached. It was entitled, The Affair of the Non-Dead Woman.
Hello, Ted.
Stevens was almost jolted from his seat. It was Dr. Weldon, professor of English at the college, an old friend of his. Quickly, he thrust the picture beneath the manuscript and moved over.
Hi, I didn't see you, Doc. Oh, here, have a seat.
Oh, I thought maybe you were giving me the, what do they call it? The brush off?
Oh, no, say, as a matter of fact, Doc, you're the one man I do want to see.
Yeah? Very flattering.
Remember those discussions we used to have about murders?
Better than bridge any time.
Well, I got the idea that you'd made sort of a hobby out of the old cases, the historical ones.
Well, I've studied quite a number of them, yes.
Ever hear of a woman named Marie Dobray?
Marie Dobray. Oh, yes. That was her maiden name, of course. One of the finest specialists in arsenic poisoning you could ever hope to find. Oh, we're almost at our station, Ted. Let's get to the door. Yes, a real charmer Marie was. Must have disposed of 50 husbands, lovers, suitors, and just plain friends before she was caught.
What happened to her, Doc?
She was beheaded and burned.
Crispin!
Oh, absurd, laughable. Ted Stevens kept saying this to himself, and yet what he knew was a foolish dread followed him straight through the small suburban station and clung to him as he reached the street. And there in the roadster was Marie, leaning toward him a little to hold the door open and smiling at him.
Oh, Ted, what on earth are you staring at?
That street light shining on your hair. I like that.
Oh, you're tight. Come on, get in the car.
Then, like a wisp of smoke, it was gone. The whole ridiculous fear, the delusion. When at home, Marie brought the cocktails into the living room. The logs were burning brightly in the fireplace, throwing a soft, dancing glow upon a room that was darkening with dusk.
To you, Marie.
And to you, dear.
As Stevens placed his glass down, he noticed the manuscript of my book. It was there on the table, right where he placed it when he first came in. Deliberately, he turned from it. And then turned back. The manuscript had been moved. Only an inch or so, but it had been moved. Keeping his back to his wife, he thrummed through that early chapter and discovered, just as he knew he would, that the photograph was gone. For a long moment, he thought of what to do. Then slowly, he turned around.
This book by Cross I brought home.
Yes?
There was a story of poisoner in it. Rather funny. Her name happens to be the same as yours. Oh, your maiden name, that is.
Oh, that is odd, isn't it?
Darling, was she a relative of yours?
Why, Ted, you're serious.
In a way, yes. Oh, I don't mean it's really important. It's just that, well, when you run across a person who's a dead ringer for your own wife and who lived 300 years ago and was a top-flight poisoner, well, you like to hear about it, that's all.
What on earth are you talking about?
Darling, be honest with me. Didn't you look at this manuscript when I was out of the room?
No.
You didn't take out a picture of a poisoner named Marie Dobray?
I most certainly did not. Oh, Ted, what is this all about? What are you getting at?
Oh, just this. Somebody took that picture out of that manuscript since I've been home. Now, who's that? Well, I'll take a look. Wait, I don't feel like... Why, it's Mark Depard.
Mark? Ted, wait a second.
Yes?
Ted, whatever it is he wants, promise you won't do it.
Promise I won't do
it? I mean, promise you won't get yourself involved. Please, Ted, don't go out tonight.
Say, what in the world is... Well, anyway, we can't let him stay outside. Mark, how are you? Come on in.
Thanks, Ted.
Just thinking about giving you a call later.
Oh, let me have your hat.
Oh, thanks. Marie, I hope you'll excuse me for popping in like this, but, well, I wanted to talk to Ted. It's rather important.
Oh, I don't mind at all.
Come on, Mark. We'll step into the library. Oh, you mind, dear?
Of course not, Ted. I'll be making the sandwiches for her.
Oh, grab that chair in the corner, Mark. Well, let's hear it.
What's the trouble? Ted, my Uncle Miles was murdered.
Murdered?
Oh, the talk hasn't reached you yet, but it's already started. Nothing definite, of course, just that there was something wrong about Uncle Miles' death.
But I don't... Mark, are you sure of this? You know he was murdered?
I don't know. Of course I don't. I just don't see how it could be any other way. Uncle Miles, you know, had been sick for quite a while. But last Saturday, he seemed so much better that Miss Corbett, that was his nurse, decided to take the day off. And, oh, you know all this. You and Marie were over that afternoon. Anyway, Lucy and I went to the club that night, to that masquerade party, and we left the old boy completely alone. I've cursed myself 1,000 times since.
But what about your housekeeper, Henderson? Wasn't she around?
Oh, sure. In that little house out in back. We told her to look in now and then, but, well, that wasn't good enough. It was after midnight when Lucy and I got back. Uncle Miles was dying. Ted, it looked exactly like one of his regular attacks. But then later, after he was gone, I happened to glance under the chest of drawers in his room. There was a small silver cup under there, almost drained, and Uncle Miles' cat. The cat was still warm, but quite dead.
Oh.
I managed to get the cat out of the house and buried without anyone seeing me. Next day, I had the contents of the cup analyzed.
It was poison?
Yes. Arsenic.
Well... What do you want me to do?
Help me open the crypt.
What?
I want to have a private autopsy performed. Help me get Uncle Miles' body out of that vault. Oh, I know it's a tough job. The thing is sealed solid, but we can do it.
You mean without the police knowing about it?
Without anybody knowing about it. Mrs. Henderson's visiting her sister, and I managed to send Lucy over to the club.
You must be crazy. You're playing with dynamite, Mark. This is something you've got to tell the police now.
I can't take that chance.
But they'll have to know sometime. You're only
delaying... I've got to know first, I tell you. You don't understand, Ted. There was somebody in Uncle Miles' room that night, handing him something in a silver cup. Mrs. Henderson was on the porch by the window. She saw her.
She saw her?
Ted. She thinks it was my wife.
Oh, Lucy.
It doesn't mean anything to Mrs. Henderson yet, because she doesn't suspect anything, but, well... Ted, you've got to see why I've got to be sure, why I've got to know how Uncle Miles died... Because it wasn't Lucy, Ted. I know it wasn't.
Of course not, Mark. She had an alibi. Well, she was with you at the club, wasn't she?
Yes. Except for half an hour.
I see.
You'll help me, won't you, Ted?
When do we start?
As soon as you can make it.
Okay. Come on now. I'll get your hat. You trot on ahead, and I'll come over as soon as I can see Marie.
But you're not going to tell her about this.
Of course not. I'll think of something. Don't you worry about it.
No, thanks, Ted. Thanks a lot.
Marie?
I'm coming.
Darling, Mark asked me to,
I know, Ted. Here. You better take your sandwiches with you. You'll be hungry.
Oh, but you knew I was going out?
Yes, I knew.
You listened to us?
I couldn't help it, Ted. I had an idea what Mark's visit was about. The talk about his uncle's death. There's a lot of gossip about it in the village. That's why I tried to tell you why I didn't want you to get mixed up in it. But it's too late now, isn't it? I mean... You're going. I can tell by the way you look. Ted, wait a second. There's just one thing I want to tell you before you leave. And that is that no matter what happens, no matter what you find or think or believe, I love you. You'll remember that, won't you?
I'll remember you said so, Marie.
By the light of a dim kerosene lantern, Mark and Ted Stevens pounded their way through the thick shelf of rock that covered the DePars ancestral tomb, pried open the great slab of stone which lay across the subterranean door, and then at last descended to the dank, ink-black chamber. They found the coffin. They dragged it from its crypt and placed it on the cold stone floor. They unclamped the lid and opened it.
Mark! It's empty.
What? That's impossible.
It can't be.
But it is, Mark. You know what this means? That body wasn't in this coffin when it was placed here.
I'll swear it was, Ted. From the time that coffin was closed on Uncle Miles, somebody, the Undertaker or Lucy or me, somebody was with it until it was buried. And the crypt was sealed right after.
Then somebody beat us to it. Somebody's broken in here ahead of us.
Broken in? Listen, Ted. Lucy and I have hardly left the house since the funeral. Do you think anybody could break in here? Smash through that stone and cement without our seeing them or without our hearing them?
Well... What?
Well, you might as well come on out then.
But who was that?
Me, Mr. DePaul. Up here. My name's Captain Brennan. I'm from the office of the Commissioner of Police.
From the...
Like to talk to you if you don't mind, Mr. DePaul. Here, follow my flashlight up.
But I don't understand. How did you know about this?
By listening, mainly. Do you mind if we go up to your house, Mr. DePaul?
Why, no. Not at all.
Oh, thank you. Oh, Freddy.
Look here, Captain.
Freddy, this is Mr. DePaul, Lieutenant Gray.
Glad to know you, Mr. DePaul.
And Mr. Ted Stevens, isn't it?
Well, how did you know my name?
Very simple. I got the names of everybody who was here at the DePaul's the day the old man died. You and your wife were included. Oh, here we are.
But I don't... Captain, who gave you those names?
Why, your housekeeper, of course.
Mrs. Henderson?
You didn't think Mrs. Henderson saw the dead cat, did you, Mr. DePaul? But she did. She also saw you bury it. And we've been interested in the case ever since. Well, nice place you have here, Mr. DePaul. Now, let's see. According to Mrs. Henderson, your wife was wearing some kind of a masquerade costume that night. What kind of a thing was it?
Well, it was... there, you can see it. It was copied from the dress in that old painting over there.
Oh, yes. Funny, where's the woman's face?
It's always been that way, long as I can remember. Somebody must have thrown acid on it or something. Can't blame them much. She was a poisoner.
A poisoner?
Yes. The story goes that one of my ancestors was responsible for her execution. Marie Dobray, her name was.
Oh, yes, I've read about her. Learned all the poison tricks from one of her lovers, a guy by the name of Gaudin St. Croix.
Gaudin St.
Oh, yes, Mr. Stevens, we cops read now and then.
Did you say Gaudin St. Croix?
That's French. We call it cross. Absolutely no limit to a cop's education, is there? But to get back to your wife, Mr. DePaul, she was dressed like the famous Marie. Now, when Mrs. Henderson looked through that window...
Just a minute, Captain. Mrs. Henderson can't prove she saw a thing, and you know it.
Now, what do you mean?
I mean you haven't any right to insinuate that my wife was in that room.
Well, who's insinuating? I'm trying to say that Mrs. Henderson, after thinking it over, realizes she was tricked by the costume. The woman she saw in the funny clothes, handing the cup of poison to your uncle, wasn't your wife at all.
What?
Because your wife is an unusually tall young woman. And the one Mrs. Henderson saw was fully half a head shorter. More on the order, let's say, of Mr. Stevens' wife.
My wife? Captain, this is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I don't know. Why, what's the matter, Mr. Stevens? You're trembling like a leaf. Tell me now, just for fun, where was Mrs. Stevens that night?
She was home, with me.
The whole evening?
Certainly.
She retired early?
Yes, we both did.
You, I suppose, were sound asleep by midnight.
Yes, I was.
Then how do you know where your wife was?
Well,
Look here, Stevens. She had to have a costume that would match Mrs. DePaul's. How did she manage that? Where did she get it?
Well, she never had one. She never had a dress like that.
And what about her motive? Why did she poison him?
I don't know.
Not for money, certainly. Then what was it? Hate? Did she hate Miles DePaul?
Yes, she did.
Damn.
No! Oh, I don't know. I don't know, I tell you.
Okay, have her picked up.
I'm going home.
Stevens, come back here.
I'm going to get my wife.
Stop him, Brennan. Now, let's go.
Good evening.
Who are you?
I? My name is Cross. Go down, Cross.
Cross? Where's my wife? What have you done to her? You fiend, what have you done to my wife?
Why, nothing at all, young man. Here, 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 sit down.
You're lying. Something's happened to her. The police just phoned. There wasn't an answer. Why are you here?
Why am I here? Well, because your wife, reading my chapter on the Dubrays, realized I knew more about the family than even she did. Because she found my phone number on the front cover of the manuscript. And because I know an exceptional case when I hear one. Does that answer your question?
No, and you know it doesn't. Can't you see I've got to know whether...
Yeah, I see. Whether your wife is that Marie Dubray, who was burnt. Burnt by order of the High Tribunal for all poison cases. The burning court of France. Witchcraft, black magic. The world across the threshold. You're quite sure, no doubt, also, that I'm Gaudin Sainte Croix, who first wooed her. No, no, my boy. No, my real name happens to be, of all things, Tom Simpson. Most unsuitable for a distinguished writing career. And Marie Dubray is no more your wife's real name than mine is Gaudin Cross.
What?
Your esteemed wife was an adopted child, Mr. Stevens. Adopted by people in Canada named Dubray. Remote members of the real family of poisoners.
I can't believe it. Why... Why didn't she tell me?
Why? Because until I told her half an hour ago, she didn't know it herself. You see, in the course of my research on the family, I found out about it. And in the course of talking with your wife, I found out something else. How for years she was haunted by the fear that she might be a poisoner by inheritance, by blood. And you can see, can't you, why she never talked about it?
Yes.
Her past to you?
Yes, yes.
And yet, Mr. Stevens, you had all but made her forget that past. You. And that's why she was willing to lie, to steal a picture, do anything, in order to hold you to her.
Yes, yes, I see that now.
You know, young man, I rather think she loves you. But as you will see, though, she comes only when I call her. Mrs. Stevens?
You mean she's...
Yes, Mr. Cross.
Marie, it's you. You're all right?
Oh, yes, dear. We're both all right now, and nothing can change it, ever.
Marie, listen.
Don't say Marie, dear. Say Maggie.
Maggie?
Oh, that's my name, my real name. Maggie McTavish. And it's a lovely name, dear. The most beautiful, gorgeous...
Darling,
ever.
Darling, please. You don't understand. The police, they think you had something to do with Miles' death.
They think I did?
So, now, Mr. Stevens, before we go back to the Depas, don't you think you'd better tell me everything that's been said and done up to date? Having just saved your wife's soul from the burning court, now I'll rest her body from the electric chair. Yes, Mr. Depas, truly excellent sherry. Don't you think so, Miss Corbett?
Yes. Yes, it's very nice.
Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, is how I happen to be here. So let us consider first that supernatural hocus-pocus in the crypt. That body that walked out of the sealed tomb. That body that never was in the tomb.
Never was in the tomb?
No, Mr. Depas. The murderer knew that very soon Mrs. Henderson's story would bring about an investigation. He had to get rid of the well-known corpus delicti.
Yes, but who could have kept the body out of the tomb?
Who, Mr. Depas? Why, you, sir.
I don't understand.
Well, it's very simple. You had the opportunity. I believe you said yourself you were alone with the body before the burial. And you had the strength. I dare say you carried it down to the furnace, where it's now probably nothing but ashes.
Ridiculous. Why would he spend an hour smashing into a crypt for a body he knew wasn't there?
Why, Captain? To impress Mr. Stevens, his witness. And also, apparently, you.
Oh, that's perfectly fantastic.
Fantastic? Oh, no, Lucy. Just comic. And I suppose, Mr. Cross, that I also put on a woman's masquerade costume, went into my uncle's room and handed him a nice cup of arsenic.
No, no, no. That had to be done by a woman. Your accomplice, as matter of fact. Oh, now, come. You mustn't all look at Mrs. Depas, because Mark Depas's one noble act was his frantic effort to prevent his wife from being charged with the crime. A crime which he and Nurse Myra Corbett committed.
Myra Corbett?
Why, you...
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Stevens, this quiet little lady beside me.
Why would I do such a thing?
Money, Miss Corbett. A cutout of Mark DePauw's inheritance. Payments for services rendered.
That's an absolute lie, Cross.
You see, ladies and gentlemen, Captain Brennan never bothered to check Miss Corbett's whereabouts on the night of the murder. Why even think of the nurse? She was the custodian of the old man's health.
Oh, you're crazy. You're crazy.
And yet, who but a nurse could so naturally offer the old man a cup? A cup he was sure contained medicine.
You're making it up. The whole thing, you're just
And who but Miss Corbett, living right here in this house, would know what kind of masquerade dress she must copy, would know when Mrs. Henderson would pass the window that night, pass and see her, and accept her, she hoped, for Lucy DePauw.
No! That's not true.
Oh, yes, Miss Corbett. Yes, Miss Corbett, that
it.
Dress was the touch that wrecked you. That was your own idea, wasn't it? Not Mark's. You weren't content with a mere murderer's share of the profits. You wanted a wife's share, half of the whole estate. You wanted Lucy DePauw convicted and out of the way for good. Well, I give you a toast, Miss Corbett, with Mr. DePauw's excellent sherry. To a particularly ruthless poisoner. And yet, you know, on the whole, I'm rather partial to female poisoners. Why, only tonight
Here, let me get to him.
Mr. Cook.
What's the matter, Brennan?
This man's dead.
Dead?
And from cyanide, if I know anything. Cyanide from that glass of sherry. Cyanide that a nurse could get quite easily. That glass was right beside you, Miss Corbett, and nobody else was near it. Too bad he didn't drink it as soon as you hoped. A second ago, we had nobody to use against you. But we have now, Miss Corbett. We have now. And I arrest you for the murder of Gordon Cross.
Now close to 5 months ago that the prominent author was murdered. And tonight, Myra Corbett pays with her life for that crime. The former nurse, at first protesting her innocence, in recent
years
has grown...
Yes, I'm in here, dear.
Oh. I thought you might... What did you cut it off for?
Huh? What do you mean?
The radio.
Oh. Oh, yeah, well, I thought you wanted to talk.
Oh, Ted, don't you think I know you better than that? What was on the radio?
Well, there wasn't any... Okay. It was about Myra Corbett. She goes to the chair tonight.
Oh.
I didn't think you wanted to be reminded.
I don't, really. But making such an effort to hide it only keeps it alive, doesn't it? All right, darling. Know what I came in to ask? If you wanted a cocktail before dinner.
The largest one you've got.
Fine. I'll get out the ice cube.
I know. If I'll fix up the fire. Okay, Maria. A deal. Where are some papers to start it?
Right there by the bookcase. And the name's not Marie. It's Maggie. Because, darling, Marie's dead and gone forever.
We're never dead. Neither of us. It was your hand that touched that glass. I know that now. And I could return the favor. But instead, I shall ask that you dispatch your husband. This one, like all the others. Now, just a little bit of poison in the drink, Marie. Any kind of a drink.
What kind, Ted?
Hmm?
What kind of a cocktail shall we have?
Oh, any kind, darling. Any kind at all.
You've just heard The Burning Court from John Dixon Carr's famous novel, the first in Columbia's new series of outstanding classics and chills by world-famous authors. Tonight's play, ladies and gentlemen, has one rather special significance we think you'd like to know about. As you perhaps have heard, every fine comedian is said to cherish a secret desire to do an abrupt about-face. He pines for the part of a blackguard. Well, tonight you witness the fulfillment of one such desire. The role of that literary and quite infamous diehard, Gordon Cross, was portrayed by none other than Hollywood's expert provoker of laughs, Charlie Ruggles, here in New York for the world premiere of his latest screen success, Friendly Enemies. The role of Marie, well, that was enacted by a young lady who long ago won national acclaim as one of Broadway's most accomplished dramatic actresses, Miss Julie Hayden. Thank you, Charlie Ruggles and Miss Julie Hayden, for your splendid performances. The play tonight, as all plays in this series, was produced and directed by Charles Vander, written by Harold Medford, and scored by Bernard Herrmann. Next week, we bring you an intensely exciting and moving drama, The Life of Nellie James. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY with the premiere episode of Suspense, first broadcast on radio on June 17, 1942, starring Charlie Ruggles and Julie Hayden. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s, when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. In a moment, Art Van Harvey and Bernadine Flynn star as Vic and Sadie, and Frank Sinatra talks about the fight against polio from 1959. Right now, here's a segment of Incredible But True as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Of all the objects in the heavens, none has been more closely nor more consistently observed than the moon. Now that man has actually walked upon her surface, one might suppose that all that can be known about her is known, and it comes as something of a surprise to learn that over all the weighty volumes of astronomic discussion hovers a haunting and tantalizing question.
Scattered over the surface of the moon in great profusion are craters, not unlike the craters produced by volcanoes on the Earth. It was one of these craters which attracted the interest of Sir William Herschel, greatest astronomer of the 18th century. On a certain night in the year 1783, he stood at his accustomed place by the window of his study, his telescope to his eye. Beside him was his sister, Caroline Herschel.
Good Lord, I must be dreaming. Here, Caroline, take the telescope.
Where shall I look?
One of the moon's craters. It's in the lowermost area, just below the Mare Imbrium.
Lights. They're all in a row, and they're moving, just like the flare of torchlights in a procession.
From then on, night after night, Sir William and his sister watched the moon, the infinitesimal pinpoints of illumination that marched mysteriously across the floor of the crater. In that same year, and again 4 years later, in 1787, the great astronomer wrote articles which carried but one implication: that the phenomenon which he had been observing was an evidence of life, that there were perhaps living, moving organisms on the surface of the moon. 60 years afterward, another eminent scientist named Rankine testified that he too had seen lights in the same crater during an eclipse. And in the decade that followed, four other observers made similar reports. Meanwhile, however, the science of astronomy had reached adulthood. The instrument it employed had gained power and precision. The men who employed them were no longer inclined toward naive and idle speculation.
It must be remembered that Sir William Herschel used a telescope of just 6 feet focal length, which he made with his own hands. Naturally, such an instrument could not produce results in which we can place any reliance whatsoever. The moon, as we now know, is totally devoid of both air and water, and so, of course, it is nonsense to speak of life on its surface.
And this was the consensus of opinion for half a century thereafter. And then the great American astronomer, William Henry Pickering, who had devoted a lifetime to planetary photography, who had traveled round the world for the sole purpose of comparing the moon's craters with the craters of the Earth, issued a statement in 1937, just a year before he died.
I have observed closely the crater which so interested my very great predecessor, Sir William Herschel. My conclusions are not entirely at variance with his. There are reasons for believing that there is life on the moon.
And so today the problem remains unresolved. And meanwhile, the moon herself rides serenely through the skies, keeping her own confidence and withholding, so far, her secret. A secret that may well prove incredible but true.
Here's a message of importance to millions of people who are continually pale and washed out, weak and run down. Doctors will tell you that these conditions are often caused by a deficiency of iron, the iron you need to build healthy blood, to keep your body function properly, and to keep you physically fit and mentally alert. Ironized yeast tablets provide you with a simple and effective way to get the daily iron your body requires. Ironized yeast is a concentrated iron tonic combined with high-potency brewer's yeast, one of the natural sources of vitamin B1. And every daily dose of ironized yeast gives you more than your daily minimum iron requirement in a form your body can easily use and put to work. Of course, pallor and weakness can come from other causes, so see your doctor regularly. But medical studies show that 2 out of 3 women, particularly those between 15 and 50, and many, many men, lack sufficient iron. So if you're not getting the iron your body needs, if you feel weak, run down, and are easily upset, get new pep, vigor, and color for only a few pennies a day. Start taking ironized yeast tomorrow.
Well, sir, the noonday meal is almost over as we join our friends at the small house halfway up in the next block now. And here in the kitchen, we find Mr. Victor Gook and young Mr. Rush Gook briskly attacking dessert. Mrs. Victor Gook, however, quitted the table a moment ago in response to the telephone's alarm. And we hear her say,
Ruthie, it completely slipped my mind. Completely slipped my mind. Yes. Sure. Well, I'm glad you remembered, lady. Vic and Rush are still here, and I can get the information from them before they have to go back to school and the office. Like I told you last week, Vic was brought up on a farm and can provide the information in 2 seconds. All right, Ruthie. Sure. Suppose I come past for you about 1:45 or kind of halfway in around through there? Yeah. All right, lady. You bet. Goodbye.
I demand to know the
mysterious Will you trot in the living room and get a sheet of paper and pencil out of the library table drawer? Finished your dessert?
Got a couple of bites left.
Well, run along. You can eat them when you get back. I'm the most forgetful ninny in town. Promised 5 separate ladies I'd dig up some information for them they need at thimble meeting this afternoon, and let it completely slip my mind.
What kind of information?
Wildflowers. You'll have to help me.
You want your good stationery, Mom?
No, any old piece of scratch paper will do. And a pencil.
Okay.
You know all about wildflowers, don't you?
Uh-uh.
Oh, you do so. Raised on a farm.
I was raised on a farm, but my horticultural education...
Well, you can certainly give me 6 names of wildflowers, can't you?
I might possibly perform that.
Sure. Feat. Here's the way it is. At the last thimble meeting, the chairman, Ms. Apparat, told us we'd have to answer to roll call this week by giving the name of a wildflower and some interesting fact about it.
Mighty sweet idea. Reminds
then I
me
have
of the time...
to accumulate this information for 5 separate ladies. Well, it was 6, counting myself.
I ripped a page out of my algebra notebook.
All right, thanks. Give it here. Now, what's the name of a wildflower?
Dandelion.
Oh, lands everybody knows dandelion.
Bluebell.
Well, can't you think of some good ones?
Well, blueberry's good. As pretty a posy as you'd want to see.
I mean something unusual. I had the notion you brought up in the country that way. It'd have 100 wildflowers on the tip of your tongue.
I worked when I was a boy. I didn't trip over the meadows gathering blossoms. I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and milked cows and watered horses.
Yeah, I know, but same time, seems to me you'd recall 1,000 wildflowers.
Well, maybe I do. Let me ponder a second.
I put down bluebell. What's an interesting fact about bluebells?
Their color.
What about their color?
It's blue.
Oh, my.
Well, heck, let a guy think a minute. I can probably recollect a trash basket full of dope if he'll give me time.
Some farm boy.
What's the trouble, Ma?
Well, I need the names of wildflowers for a Thimble Club meeting this afternoon.
Why?
Oh, new stunt of Miss Apparat's. At roll call, instead of answering off Miss Gook and Miss Stembottom, the ladies are supposed to give a wildflower and some interesting fact about it. You know any wildflowers?
I expect I could think of a few. Do you have to provide them for all the ladies?
Have to provide them for 5. Well, thought of something?
Chrysanthemum.
Oh, chrysanthemum. Since when was chrysanthemums wild?
I didn't know.
Must have been some wide-awake farm boy.
Well, why do you have to dig up information for everybody?
I guess I stuck my neck out. I had the idea my husband, that had been brought up in the country, could name off names of wildflowers fast as he could talk.
No, but why do you
Well,
have
when
to...
Thimble let out last week, I walked partway home with Ruthie and Miss Carmelson and Miss Welch. They said they didn't know any more about wildflowers than a person could shake a stick at. I told them I'd help them out. And pretty quick, Miss Crider and Miss Oliver caught up with us, and they were up a stump about wildflowers. I said I'd get their information for them.
Huh.
And then I proceeded to promptly forget the whole business. Puts me in a pickle if you can't help. I've had all week to go down to the public library, and here's the afternoon of Thimble meeting, and I haven't got a thing.
You've got Bluebell.
Oh, Bluebell. I thought you'd know a bunch of dandies.
Oh, maybe I do. Let me think.
Sweet Williams, ma. Sweet Williams are wildflowers, ain't they?
Sweet Williams? Sure.
I remember seeing
What's
Sweet Williams.
What's an interesting fact about them?
I don't know.
Tulips, kiddo.
Are tulips wildflowers?
Far as I know, they are.
You must have been a regular leatherhead when you were on the farm.
I was a bright, alert,
sunflowers,
ma.
Well, they're wild.
Well, they're wild, but they're common. Anybody can think of sunflowers and dandelions and daisies. I told the ladies I'd provide them with fancy names. Fancy names and unusual facts. And your father gives me chrysanthemums and tulips.
Irises.
Irises.
Is this the way it goes, ma'am? Miss Apparat calls off Miss Gook, and you're supposed to holler out Sweet Williams?
Supposed to holler out Sweet Williams and go ahead and speak some little piece about Sweet Williams. Sweet Williams grow some place or other and are widely known for this, that, and the other thing.
Rotten splotches.
What?
Wildflowers. Rotten splotches. They grow on the banks of creeks. We had a whole patch of rotten splotches on our farm. They're kind of a nasty yellow with dirty streaks on them.
Ish.
Rotten splotches is a good, legitimate wildflower. I can
prove... You think I'd give that to any of the ladies to say... Rotten splotches, a nasty yellow flower with dirty streaks on it.
Well, heck, I'm doing the best I can.
Telephone's ringing.
It's probably Ruthie again.
Might be Leland Richards. He said he had something of a trivial nature to discuss.
I'll answer. Hello? Oh, yes, Miss Carmelson. Why, yes, I am, Miss Carmelson. I promised Miss Stembottom I'd stop by for her. Oh, they're wildflowers? Yes, yours is Sweet William. Yes, Sweet William. What's an interesting fact, Bill?
I'm afraid I
Rush?
Wouldn't have the slightest...
Sweet Williams were discovered by Balboa when he explored the Pacific coast.
Who?
Balboa.
Excuse me, Miss Carmelson. Had to ask my son a question. Yeah. Sweet Williams were discovered by Balboa when he explored the Pacific coast. Balboa. Can you remember that? All right. Oh, not at all. Well, see you at Thimble Club later on. Yes, indeed. All right, Miss Carmelson. Bye.
Well, you got one of your ladies fixed up.
Hush, was that true about Sweet Williams?
True?
Yes.
Could be true.
You don't know it's true, though, huh?
No, I don't know it's true. But it's got to be partly true. Balboa must have seen plenty of Sweet Williams.
I'll get it.
Carnations.
Carnations or wildflowers?
Seems to me I heard somewhere that carnations are... What?
Hello. Oh, yes, Miss Oliver. Sure I have. You bet. What's another?
Killy Connects.
Killy Connects?
Yeah.
Killy Connects, Miss Oliver. Yeah, that's your wildflower. Interesting fact.
Killy Connects were used by the Comanche Indians to tell the time of day.
They were used by the Comanche Indians to tell the time of day. Yeah. Oh, not at all, Miss Oliver. Not at all. See you this afternoon? All right. All right, Miss Oliver. Goodbye.
Another lady accommodated.
What are Killy Connects?
Marbles. They're generally used for shooters, and they're made out of some kind of funny stone. Kids call them Killy Connects.
Where'd you get that about the Comanche Indians?
We're reading about Comanche Indians in English class.
Both Miss Carmelson and Miss Oliver will call out stuff at thimble meeting that ain't true.
Nobody will check up on them, though. If you take the average American citizen, he wouldn't bother to go to the trouble.
I need four more wildflowers and interesting facts.
Heliotrope.
You needn't exert yourself giving any more suggestions, Vic. Rush, I'm going to use sunflower after all. What's an interesting fact?
Sunflowers were once used as food.
Is that true?
No.
Once used as food.
Sweet peas.
What's an interesting fact about daisies?
Daisies keep secrets. There's an old saying, daisies won't tell.
That's true.
Sure.
I'll give it to Ruthie. How about bluebells?
They're blue.
How about bluebells, Rush?
Bluebells were once held sacred by the Blackfoot tribe of Redskins.
Kiddo, seems to me orchids are wildflowers.
Dandelions?
Want an interesting fact for dandelions?
Yeah.
There's an old tradition that if you hold a dandelion under somebody's chin and it makes their skin look yellow, it shows they like butter.
That's true.
I don't know whether it's true or not, but you take young kids...
Well, and... I mean, it's true people say that.
Yeah.
Well, makes my six. Sweet Williams, that funny name...
Killy Connects.
Sunflowers, daisies, bluebells, and dandelions.
Uh-huh, six.
Certainly made a botch of this, making ladies call out trash that ain't even true.
I wouldn't worry, Ma. You'll never get caught.
Kiddo.
What?
Poinsettias.
You're some farm boy, you are.
Ain't poinsettias wildflowers?
Some wonderful farm boy.
Which concludes another brief interlude at the small house halfway up in the next block.
Mrs. Frank Sinatra, suppose you were told that a major operation, though not essential, would change your entire life, open new and wider chances for happiness. Would you consent? Well, this was the decision that faced a young man named Ansar. Ansar lived in Indonesia. He lived, though never in his 19 years had he walked or taken a single step. He was a polio victim at the age of 3 months, and when he learned to creep, he had to continue creeping because his legs were too weak for walking. At the age of 19, he was admitted to the rehabilitation center at Solo, where surgery and vocational training are given. They examined him and decided surgery could help. But Ansar refused, absolutely. He said he'd only come there to learn a trade. All he wanted was to be a shoemaker or a tailor or something like that, so he could work sitting still the rest of his life. He refused the operation. So, one might ask, what was the good of this remarkable rehabilitation center in the case of Ansar? It was here that Dr. Sohaso, an Indonesian surgeon, began operating on and repairing as best he could the victims of the 6 years of bitter fighting in that area. And all the time, he thought of the problems that would face these incapacitated men and women. So at the end of the war, he looked for a place to continue rehabilitation work. And the only place available was a garage. And people came to him for help, garage or no garage. There were too many with bodies often too damaged to be given aid in this place. Everything was crude except the good intentions. So, Dr. Sohaso looked around for help. But how could he expect anyone to notice his problems in a remote corner of Indonesia? Nevertheless, it did happen. He went on with his work, and in time, word of what was being done at Solo reached the United Nations. The UN sent the well-known American rehabilitation expert, Dr. Henry Kessler, to Solo to observe and report. And it was Dr. Kessler's conviction that the work being done at Solo was unique in that part of the world and could be a model for the whole area. After that, the story becomes one of a remarkable bit of cooperation among government, the United Nations, and many agencies and organizations. Now, there is an orthopedic hospital teaching program, a surgery and all the modern requirements, laundry, kitchen, hot water, sanitation facilities. Also, a brace shop for making braces and artificial limbs, and a vocational shop. But our young friend Ansor gave no thought to an operation for himself. The fact of the matter was that Ansor was much too frightened. But in the ward, he soon made friends. One young fellow in particular interested him, a boy named Mardi. Ansor felt so sorry for poor Mardi because Mardi's hands had been injured and were useless to him. And Ansor brooded about this so much, he discussed it with the nurses and learned that Mardi could be helped if he would submit to a series of operations. After all, even though Ansor himself had troubles, he did have the use of his hands. Well, it seemed to Ansor a terrible pity that Mardi didn't let them operate. Finally, he had to speak to Mardi, tell him he must let the doctors help. Well, maybe it seems ironic, but Ansor was quite shocked when he learned Mardi felt the same way toward him, pitied him. He, Ansor, felt he should let the doctors operate. And so they argued about their cases, kept trying to argue each other to the operating table, until it became a case of, I will if you will. Well, at that point, Ansor couldn't let his friend Mardi go first. He had too much pride for that. So, although Ansor was terrified, he rode into the operating room. Later, when he was on his crutches learning to walk, he had the privilege of giving courage to his friend Mardi. Now, here they are, both recovering and telling each other all about their operations. And that is how two lives were transformed in a garage in Solo, a tiny spot on the map of Indonesia.
Yes, Jell-O is a grand, exciting treat. A perfect joy to look at, and when it comes to taste, well, there's simply nothing finer. Jell-O adds a glamorous touch to any meal. Gay, sprightly colors, rich, tantalizing flavor, all blended together in a bright, tangy dessert of enticing goodness. So tomorrow night, lend new delight to dinner with a clear, radiant mold of shimmering Jell-O in any one of Jell-O's six delicious flavors. The name Jell-O is a trademark, the property of General Foods. And when you buy, look for those big red letters on the box. That way, you can always be sure of getting the flavor that made Jell-O famous.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY with Frank Sinatra narrating the fight against polio from 1959. And we also heard an episode of Vic and Sadie, starring Art Van Harvey and Bernadine Flynn. First broadcast on radio on September 22nd, 1939. This has been the Golden Age of Radio. Classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows. On the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.